In South Africa today, the phrase illegal mining immediately evokes danger, collapsed shaft, armed gangs, environmental destruction, and violent turf wars. But beneath that headline is a more complicated story, because not everyone digging underground is part of organized crime. Some are surviving where formal mining jobs have disappeared. Other communities are sitting on mineral wealth, but excluded from it. Today, we ask a difficult question. Are we confronting crime or managing economic desperation? And what happens to the communities that are caught between the two? My guest in the studio with me today is Kgothatso Ntlengetwa, an artisanal mining practitioner and small-scale mining services entrepreneur, and Sabelo Mnguni, the national coordinator for Makau, Mining Affected Communities in Action. And he is a passionate advocate for communities that are affected by mining. So let's start by defining our terms. I think there's a big debate happening in the country, but everybody has a different understanding of what we are talking about. And Kgothatso, I'll start with you. What is artisanal mining, and is it different from illegal mining?
Well, you started right in the crux of the matter. I'm so glad you did that, because that's where I always like to start anyway. So I think it's important to see. We start with that definition so that going forward we can have a greater understanding. So me, I have an academic background. So, you know, I always want to default to academics. Now, when you go to academics, its question is, what is the definition of artisanal mining, academically speaking from the books? And the truth of the matter is there's no academic definition. It just depends where you go. If you go to England, they will, if you go to Cambodia and an English organization is going to tell you it's based on high labor intensive, very high labor intensive, it's based on low levels of technologies. So the definition is descriptive. But when we come to the South African aspect, it's very simple. Artisanal mining is more community-based, and it's more informal rather than illegal. What do I mean by that? There's no syndicates. That's the difference with artisanal mining. There's no syndicates. Number two, it often happens in traditional areas. So you'll find where there's headmen, there's chiefs, and there's rural leadership. Then they'll ask for permission to mine from the rural leadership. And then also something that's very different is that often it's South African-based. There are migrants who are active, but in the more artisanal mining, the community-based mining, it's more South African-based mining. Whereas the illegal mining, I'm a syndicate. Here we're talking about criminals that traffic people from Lesotho, from Swaziland, from Mozambique, in order for them to work underground as exploitative pawns within the illegal mining scheme.
So when we say, or when even policymakers say Zama Zamas, are they, you know, are they erasing this legitimate mining and lumping everybody into the same thing?
That's exactly the problem. You know, I work with an organization called the National Association of Artisanal Miners. And from as early as 2019, they have been calling for definitions to be made of what artisanal mining really is. Because a Zama Zama who goes underground and who is under the guise of having a boss somewhere who tells him what to do is very different from a group of miners who come together and say, let's try and make a company, a cooperative, because that's what they do. They form cooperatives, you know, and they form a cooperative and they say, let's try and mine what's on the ground. But now they never get the permit. And that's the problem, because abana permit, they're mining illegally. And that's why you can all call them illegal miners. Because as long as in South Africa you don't mine with a permit, because small-scale mining permits are available according to our current legislation. So as long as you don't have that mining permit, you are considered to be illegal, even if you might be doing it in a more community base rather than having guns and being part of gangs.
So from a community perspective, mining affected communities, affected communities, what happens when a big mine leaves? We were talking earlier about where you are from. So the big mines leave, but the mineral is still there. The jobs are gone. The formal jobs are gone, but the skill is not gone. The people still know what work, and they used to work there anyway. So what happens in the community to those people? Is this how then the problem starts to come into effect where you can't get a license? How does this affect the community?
Okay, no, thanks. So remember, when there's formal mining, there's also informal economy around that formal mining. So if big corporates leave and then they leave derelict or unreputed shafts, obviously it creates one danger to us as a community, because now that shaft becomes a target for illegal miners or illegal for the syndicates, particularly those who normally go underground, who target the shafts. What we saw in Stilfontein, what is happening currently in Springs, what is happening in Pegastal or Western area, then you'll find that those who are working in the mines will also be recruited, will find themselves going to the shaft once those shafts become active. What it also does, it kills the informal economy around our community. Then it creates a vacuum, economic vacuum. So obviously, that economic vacuum, most of the time, we close it with informal economy again and also criminal activities. So derelict and abandoned shaft create an environment for criminality to take place in general. And also, what it also creates, it creates an environmental hazard. Remember, some of those shafts have got methane, we've got tailing dams that are not well treated. So it creates a lot of environmental problems for us as a community. What it does in turn, that environmental problems, they create health issues. And we know we are not well structured in terms of primary health care institutions in our community. Our clinic are not well equipped to deal with tuberculosis, are not well equipped to deal with any respiratory illnesses, including cancer that we contact or that we find ourselves developing because of living closer to tailing dams, living closer to those shafts. So it does perpetuate criminality to continue, and especially if the shafts are not guarded, are not well demarcated. These mining companies just leave open holes. Then obvious will come in. The samas will come in. Even the term, as Khutaz was saying, it pokes everyone in the same way. If I can expand also in terms of the definition, artisanal miners are people who are using rudimentary tools. We just use normal home or domestic tools. We don't use machinery. And then when you look at illegal miners, they are well funded. They use yellow machine plants. We don't know where the mineral is going once it's extracted. They normally target shafts. Shafts are very dangerous to work on. But then they will exploit people. They will exploit those who are coming from other countries. And then we'll find ourselves having a situation now at the community level. Once there is an artisanal, or not artisanal miners, what is illegal mining happening? What it creates, we get divided to some extent. Because we as South Africans, we hesitate to go underground, dangerous. And then those who are exploited from Lesotho, who are kidnapped or in any sense brought to South Africa illegal, they are pushed to go underground. They will start working underground. They will make more money. And then there will be a difference between a Sabelo, who's a South African, and a Kabelo, who's a Lesotho national, in terms of a socioeconomic status at the community level. That one is money, that this one doesn't have money. And then there is a division. Now, we as those who are having informal economies, activities, let's say I've got rooms, I've got a tavern, I've got food stall, all routes, we start benefiting from them. Now, what it creates, those who are benefiting in terms of economic activities, they feel like this illegal mining, it's working for them. In other communities, it does work for the other community members in general, because they benefit. While those, they will come and buy vegetables and then do those things. But generally, abandoned shafts are causing danger to our community.
So I hear from both of what you're saying, that there really are two realities. There's organized criminal syndication and extraction on the one side, and on the other side is a community trying to survive, economic survival, as it were. So how do we then differentiate? How do you in a community differentiate and separate the criminal element from the survival element? Can you differentiate? How?
Yes, okay. As I said, normally those who are conducting illegal activities, they go underground, they target the shafts. And then artisanal miners, most of the time, we are working surfaces. We'll go to a tailing dam, we'll try to service that tailing dam. We'll go where there's rubble, mine waste areas. We normally work those areas. We don't normally go deep underground. We work just the surface, shallow holes and stuff. That's the difference. And we work in daylight most of the time. They work daylight. It's not like kuti bazifihla. Basebenza, everyone can see them. Mm-hmm. But then the illegal miners or those who go underground, you don't see what is happening and how they look, the equipment they are using. They will wear PPE that demonstrates that I work underground, I don't work in the surface. Mm-hmm. Versus you won't find a Khutazo that is working in a tailing dam wearing a hard hat. What are you doing with the hard hat? You can see you are outside leadership.
But this picture that you are painting on the one side, you're talking to me about individuals who have the skill. When it comes to small scale miners, is there a space because of this hard to come by permits? Is there a space for corruption then that festers even for people who could be considered artisanal miners or small scale miners because of the licensing issues?
Yeah, I mean, you know, currently, as it currently stands, the MPRDA, which is the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, is what governs the South African mining space. Now, of that act, Section 27 says you can apply for a small-scale mining permit, and that mining permit mustn't be greater than 5 hectares. Now, that's what it says. And in all theoretical ways, you should be able to simply apply and get your mining permit. But from what happens on the ground, that's not what really happens. You need the right connections, first of all, to get even a prospecting license. Not even a small-scale mining permit. Ask a figgy. Just to go to bege. Already there's corruption just to get that prospecting permit. To be able to just check out what's on the ground. Let alone go from prospecting permit to a mining permit. And now there's the artisanal and small scale mining policy, which was gazetted in 2022. Now in that policy, which is what feeds to the new bill that's being amended, because you know the act, the Mining Act, the MPRDA is being amended with the new bill. And so the policy spoke to the amendments regarding artisanal mining. And one of the things it says, and we were doing this because we're actually reviewing the bill and giving comments for it, and my company was requested to do so. One of the things it says permits will be given on a first-come, first-served basis, but the minister reserves the right to select who gets mining permits. Can you see what that's doing?
That's where the door is.
Can you see what that's doing? Is that, no, it's first-come, first-served, but there's a reservation for certain people who'll be able to get these mining permits. Now the thing is, we as the people in the space are so caught up. Hey, at least we're formalizing. We've got legislature. But let's be careful. How are we formalizing? Are we formalizing so that it can be used as a way to be exploited? You get what I mean? So there is imbobo is there, you know. For the to become, because as long as there's no transparency, because what we said when, as people who do on the ground, we said let there be a panel or a team that includes different artisanal mining bodies, because there are cooperatives now that form into national bodies. I mean, there's already, I know so far, of two associations of artisanal miners that are at national level already. So we can have representatives of those sitting on a team, making sure that there is transparency in who gets given these mining permits. Because otherwise, we're going to have more tenderpreneurs that are just going to be mining entrepreneurs, quote-unquote mining entrepreneurs.
Savelo, this makes me wonder, because you talk about theoretically, anyone can get a license if they apply for it on a first-come, first-served basis, but with a provision for the minister. Does the community have the experience, have the expertise to go for licenses? Or is this the reason why a lot of community members find themselves illegally mining?
No, there's, in the majority of the community, we don't know it takes civil society to educate or capacitate communities around understanding even your basic human rights. Being able to link human rights violations with activities, especially economic activities that are happening within your doorstep, is very difficult for community to identify. So if we are struggling to identify human rights violation, then obviously in terms of legislation, understanding how we need to access mining, it's worse. Generally, they don't know it. It takes UNAM, it takes Bomakua and other organizations like that to capacitate the community. The state is not doing enough. Or is not doing anything at all to bridge that capacity gap within the communities, especially communities that are protected by MPRTA Section 27, is Section 102. There's also Section 102 in MPRTA that speaks about us being given first preference in terms of tailing dams, to access tailing dams. But you'll find, again, that this framework, but then that framework is meant to marginalize us because Section 102...
The fact that you even know the section as a number.
Yeah. What it says for you to be given that first preference, you must demonstrate financial capacity. How can I demonstrate financial capacity as a community member? As it is, I can't demonstrate financial capacity to buy bread. But then for me to get that payment, I need to demonstrate. Then that's where exploitation comes in. That's where you will find there are Chinese within this small scale mining. You will find there are investors who are coming from foreign nationals, who are foreign nationals that are taking advantage of that fact that we don't have financial resources. Our law requires us to demonstrate. So we don't know it. And once we start knowing it, it becomes frustrating. As let me give a simple example. Compliance just to have a cooperative or a company is tedious. We know it, but no one knows it all. You'll have your tax certificate, you'll have your company registration certificate. Opening a bank account costs 500. Alone, that frustrates you to get the documents that requires you to apply. So, yeah, legislation in South Africa, if you pay close attention, it's not meant for us. It's meant to keep us at bay.
So, you say government is not doing enough to capacitate people or ensure transparency for people and how they get licenses. But the one thing we do know, that government is doing, and the president even made a big show of it at the State of the Nation, is they're very quick when there is a problem that we see in the news to bring in the military to clamp down with the army, the police, every resource is then thrown at the people. When such a thing happens, who are the first affected people? Is it the syndicates or is it the community that's affected first when the army comes in?
I think, our position around the deployment of the military, of militarization of community struggles, is that instead of looking at the causes, we are dealing with the symptoms to some extent. Because now, what causes us to commit illegal activities? Where does it emanate from? So, policing alternative ways of getting bread into a table is human rights violation to some extent, because the military will come in, it will be a temporary solution. Activities will cease because there's military at the community. They will leave. Once they leave, everything commence. Everything start again. While the military is there, socio-economic issues are not addressed. They are there just to deal with the criminal element, criminal part of it. And we know, even the state it knows that majority of those who go underground are exploited to go underground. There are people who are controlling and running these syndicates. We don't see military being deployed there. We haven't seen anything. This Operation Valamco that spends over $1 billion. But ever since Operation Valamco started, we haven't seen any so-called kingpin being arrested. So our position as a movement is we feel like what the government is doing is being reactive and wants to show media that we are doing something. Yes, it's not addressing anything at the ground. Illegality, these are again another position that we have for us in terms of illegal mining as a term. Once when the time when Stilfontein, we attended court hearings full time on a full time basis. I was there. The magistrate couldn't hold anyone to account in terms of illegal mining. In terms of our legislation, we don't have such a thing as illegal mining, people were arrested for holding gold bearing materials for trespassing only. And then when you come to legality, this corporate, your Anglo, your Harmony and stuff, they are committing illegalities in their operations. But we haven't seen any deployment or a law being taken in terms of addressing the human rights violation that occurs because of corporate mining. We haven't seen any mining companies being held to account in terms of violating their mining conditions. Not complying to SLP is we are violating your mining conditions. Not complying to NEMA or environmental
SLP
authorization.
For people who don't know are social labor plans.
Social and labor plans, sorry, yes. Without non-compliance.
Which is part of benefiting the
community.
The community itself. And how you do business within the community as big mining companies.
Exactly. As per legislation. And it's legally binding. Mm. So if you are not implementing your obligations as per the social and labor plan, it means you are not adhering to the law. So what are you doing in turn? We are operating illegally.
So, talking about illegal mining and this term not existing, and you, because of your background in the academics part of the industry sector too, what does that then mean? Are you saying that illegal mining, as it is termed in the news by communities and the way that we see it, is it a policing problem? Or is it a policy problem or an economic failure, in your view, Hotazo?
Well, I think it's a complex problem that touches on multiple facets. Mm. It's a socioeconomic problem, first and foremost. Second of all, it's a mining issue. It's a technical issue. And when I say technical, I mean now the geology of it. I'm talking about the mining as technologies of it. I'm talking about the health and safety of it. So even the technical aspects, there's issues there. Policy and policing go hand in hand. Because like my co-speaker Sabelo had said earlier on, is that if the legislature does not fit what's happening at grassroots level, it will never be implementable. So even if, for example, we can write a very fantastic on paper policy or bill or act on artisanal small scale mining, that policy won't make sense unless we take what's happening on the ground to feed into that policy. And then the last thing, which is very important, the home affairs aspect, sovereignty aspect. We're talking about a sector that is full of migrants. And I call them migrants because I don't want to just say illegal. Because there are legal migrants.
Well,
that
we've
are
always
working.
Had yes. The mining sector has always had
yes.
labor sending areas, and we
yes.
know that Malawi, Lesotho, Tutu, Zimbabwe, Swaziland. Mozambique, these were labor sending areas.
Yes.
Even during apartheid tax.
Exactly.
That's who sent the labor.
Exactly.
You were talking, Sabelo, earlier about the fact that primarily South Africans, except for from the Eastern Cape, are unwilling to go deep underground. And this is a legacy issue.
No, definitely, for sure. And so because of that, one of the biggest approaches that must be done is a holistic approach. Because, you know, trying to look at it and using the iron fist approach, it doesn't work. You know, there's other countries. There's two countries I just want to highlight, Tanzania and Zambia. Now, when it regards to ASGM, and ASGM, the G is just for gold, artisanal and small-scale gold mining.
Okay.
The G just stands for gold. And they specifically looked at gold because just like in South Africa, in those countries you have quite a lot of gold endowment. And what they did, instead of looking at it as a punitive approach, what they did, they said, how about we try and work with the artisanal miners and see if we can't have them formalized? So in Tanzania, there's actually an arm of the state called STAMICO, and its sole purpose is to help small-scale miners. That's its sole mandate. And it helps miners from technical. So, for example, how do they help them technically? Technically, they said, we can get you geological drills, but instead of mining and of drilling at 100 rand a meter, we can drill for you 50 rand a meter. Can you see now? They're not saying we're giving you money. They're not saying we work on a mine for you. They're saying, let's make it more affordable for you. And even the equipment that they use, they've now even organized the traders, the gold traders, because they realized we can't organize the miners and not organize the traders, because the traders are also informal, but they work hand in hand in this value chain. So now they've organized the traders. So now they're getting a value chain. And when you look at how much money they're actually getting on tax revenue from the small scale mining, it's increased. And the one where I was watching, they were taking from 2024 to 2024 in the presentation where I was. And it's really increased because they've said, okay, we can see this opportunity. It's not a problem. So it's an opportunity.
By not formalizing this environment, you're telling us how it could look if it were formalized and done correctly or properly.
Yes.
Do you think we're missing, as South Africa, are we missing an opportunity to bridge the job creation aspect of our problems?
Definitely. You know, small-scale mining has a large value chain. When you look at the jobs in small-scale mining, there's a stat that says for every one artisanal miner that you have six downstream job activities. So the jobs that we're creating are not only within the actual mine. So within the mine, you'll have the miners, you'll have the processors, but then you'll also have the ladies who sell food to them. You'll also have those who sell petrol for the generators. Then you also have people who are helping them with transport, the buggies. So you have this whole economy that rises there. But also, if you actually look, you know, I've just been on a national project working with the Department of Fisheries and Forestries and Environment, and you can see that they actually have systems. We are assuming that informality means there's no systems in place. That's not true. They have systems. They have hierarchies. They are organized. We just need to see what they're already doing, expand on it, and make it better in order for them to be in the formal space, especially these community-based miners. The syndicate-based, that's a bit more tricky to deal with, because there we have to look at the head of the snake, and we're busy dilly-dallying with the tail of the snake with the zamazamas that are going down underground. But I'm telling you, some of the people sitting in that parliament are the top of that snake.
Yes.
Well, you know, you talk about dealing with the tail of the snake. Are we at risk of criminalizing poverty in the way that we are dealing with small-scale, artisanal, unpermitted miners? Is that what we're doing?
You're correct. That's what we're doing. We are criminalizing poverty. We are using military to combat people who are trying to survive. It's unconscionable, to be honest. Because even if we allow the state, or it continues to use the major strategies that they are using currently, illegal mining or informal mining benefits mostly formal market or formal economy. Because when you look at those who go underground, especially, what are they using to extract the gold? Where do they buy it? Where do they buy the generator? Do we have anyone who's formally manufacturing generators? Do we have anyone who's informally manufacturing petrol? No, we don't have. Where do they get the mercury? Where do they get the supplies? All those things. The yellow machine that we saw in Bapong. Where do they get it? Where do they get the diesel? So who benefits at the end is the mainstream economy. From where we are sitting, the pushback not to formalize it, especially including active artisanal miners who are part of the industry, is because of Mineral Council to some extent. The big mining companies, they don't want us to participate in the space because they want the minerals for themselves. What is happening in Iran is the same thing. What happened in Venezuela is the same thing. To say use military to ensure we distract them, not to participate. When you look at the proposed bill, that one is worse.
So if we do nothing, what happens in 5 years? If you project based on the experience on the ground, the experience with the people that you work with, if nothing changes, what does it look like in 5 years' time?
There will be pushback from communities. Because
what is a pushback from communities? What do you mean?
Okay, yeah, let me explain it in a sense. As I said earlier, where there's illegal mining or artisanal mining. That means, because if I say oh, it means they are the same. Operation Valamukoti and this military, they don't know the difference between the two. Those who are part of the syndicate and those who are doing it for survival, they stop everyone. So if they stop everyone, then there's no economy flow within the community. Nothing is happening. We are pushed back into poverty. And once we are hungry, we can do anything. So there will be retaliation. Is it a retaliation in the form of, instead of having 10 Zamazamas, now you left 80 Zamazamas? Because they saw it works and it does give back to in their pocket. What we'll see criminality goes, criminality activities, because of my socio-economic issues. Another thing that the state is doing by deploying military, they're not deploying or creating alternative economies around to curb what push us to go to underground, what push us to use it well. You understand? They are not doing those things. They are just combating without doing anything.
No alternative.
There's no alternative. So if there's no alternative, what will happen? In 5 years, it means we will be more impoverished as a community. Then we'll start doing more illegal activities on a broader spectrum in general. Because artisanal mining, as Khotazo was saying, there are people that are benefiting, that are creating, selling food, housing, laundry, and all those things around where these mining activities are happening. If it ceases, then Ekapa is closing now. Kimberley is a coast town as it is. Once Ekapa closed, what will happen to Kimberley? You have DPRs that wants to become a small scale miner now. DPRs in Kimberley, they want to apply for artisanal mining permits, of which we are suspecting Sibanye is want to move in that direction. So these big mining companies are exploiting the system that the government is trying to introduce in terms of small scale artisanal mining, because the state also, what it did, it makes it not easily accessible by putting AMA prices aphezulu, about 200 and something thousand for a payment, 300, 500. You need an environmental impact assessment report. You must hire environmentalists, you must hire geologists. How can you demonstrate? How can you get those things as a community member? So those, they will come in again. But then if we continue, as I said, we continue as we are moving, criminalizing poverty, then our communities, things will be worse at the community level, to be honest.
Kotato, your last word. If nothing changes, where are we in 5 years?
Artisanal mining will thrive, but it will thrive in the dark. Because let us not assume that just because it's in the dark, it's not thriving. Yes. I can tell you for a fact that artisanal miners thrive. But they thrive in the dark, and they thrive with people that shouldn't be benefiting with them. Mm. You understand me? So whether or not we're going to send the military or not, it still doesn't stop the fact that this morning I was on the phone with people on the Northwest who are busy sluicing as we speak, even if there's military. Because the gold price is sitting at over 4.5.
Even.
And it's not going down anytime soon. They've tried to curb mercury. So what they did is they curbed mercury. Mercury is more expensive, but still.
Mm.
So it's either way, artisanal and small-scale mining will continue with or without the government formalizing it. The only thing that will make it better, that will make it efficient, that will make it effective in really making a difference socially to the socio-economic issues of the ground, the only way is if we formalize it. The government is starting to see that, but the question is, are they really taking into cognizance what's really happening on the ground and are not just doing a top-down approach? Because we need to be top-down, bottom-up, and meet in the middle.
Sabelo, you were talking earlier about how these big mining companies are shifting to also exploit some of how the government is changing in this mineral sector and the licensing for small-scale miners. And we have been watching how illicit trade and the illicit environment has impacted the tobacco industry, so much so that the big guys like BAT and all of those guys are shutting down and leaving. Do you think that the illegal, illicit space in South Africa in the mining environment could have the same impact?
Perpetuated or conducted by these corporate companies. Already, these companies, there's a research that we done with an illicit comrade Kobul, but with economist Duma Kobul. What it showed is, in the previous 10 years, in terms of mining profits, have increased around 600%. In terms of royalties and taxes that are paid, they are paying to the state, have increased with almost 80%. So in the previous 10 years, mining companies are paying less to the state, are getting more money. So alone, we are not getting anything because of mining companies. ArcelorMittal is closing because iron ore or metal that is created by iron ore is no longer viable. They want chrome and then all those things. Already we are seeing mining companies are shutting down and the steel industry is being affected in a serious way. Other economies are also being affected. So illicit financial flow, what it does, it takes away all the income that we need to be having as a state. And our state is watching, is not doing anything. As I spoke about Operation Vulnerable, that is bias. Why we are not seeing any committee that is being established or anything that is being done to cap or to deal with illicit financial flows from the mining sector? Anglo has left South Africa after mining for more than 150 years without rehabilitating, without paying workers. Ekapa is leaving. A lot of companies, mining companies, are leaving our shores without benefiting. So alone, we have seen profits and minerals being taken away, but we are not seeing anything happen in our community. We are continuously seeing ghost towns emerging in all these communities. So some of these financial flows that from these monies that are leaving our shores without being tracked, they are also contributing to the socio-economic impact that we are having. Remember, South Africa is number one in terms of inequality in the whole world. So, in terms of critical minerals or minerals, we are rated number three, number four. We are up there, but inequality. What causes that inequality is the shenanigans that are happening between the state and the corporate sector.
So, in terms of formalizing the environment for artisanal miners and small scale miners, very recently the South African Human Rights Commission was holding public hearings about the sector. And I know Makua was one of the organizations that made submissions there. Do you think that enough was done with those hearings? Did they listen to enough of the people you're talking about ground up and not just top down? Do you think that commission's work is any kind of impact on making sure that formalizing the sector takes everybody along?
Yeah, you know, for me, is I think any sort of evidence, you know, reaching things that want to bring evidence-based research into the debate on artisanal and small-scale mining, I think any form of activity that does that is a very good thing. Excuse me. But here's where I think the problem is. The problem is that it's a slice through time. It's literally done within a space of 2 to 3 months, and it hears the narratives for that 2 to 3 months. What's needed in the space is more longitudinal. So we need something that says, yes, this is what we heard these 2 to 3 months. That is one quarter. But let's see what happens in the second quarter. Let's see what happens in the third quarter and the fourth quarter. The reason why is because, contextually speaking, artisanal and small-scale mining is changeable on the ground, depending not only on geopolitics, but also depending even on things like seasons, on things like, you know, what's changed in the community, the gold price, the mercury price, is the scarcity of water, have there been rains? All of those little things affect everything that happens on the ground. And we've seen in some of the research work that I've done is how those contextual changes that are unique to the ground actually play a bigger role than most people see, even at high-level research activities such as the one held by the SHRC. So it's very important to have studies like that. And I think to have that in South Africa is very important because for once, the voices are being heard, even of the layman on the ground.
Mm.
But it's also important to know this can't just be it. It can't be just one study in a slice through time and that's that. Mm. There needs to be something more continual so that we can track and see, is there really empowerment? Is there really formalization? Is there really changes?
Do you feel like your voice was heard or were they just ticking a box by showing up and making your submission?
In terms of South African Human Rights Commission?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, our voice was heard. The challenge is the state departments are not speaking to each other. And these hearings are the second one. In 2013, 14, 15, they conducted the same research, the South African Human Rights Commission, and made recommendations. But then when you look at the amendments that were making the regulations in 2019, the MPRTA regulations, Department of DMR ignored, intentionally ignored those recommendations. Even with the current bill for 2025, they ignored those recommendations. What they also did, each and every time when there's a legislative amendment, the state conduct what they call CS assessment, socioeconomic impact assessment research to check the socioeconomic issues around that particular legislation. When they did this one, they didn't include things that they included themselves in their CS report
in the
bill. Yeah, the current one that is ongoing. Mm. So the challenge is that these other departments are trying. Department of Fisheries and Environment in Velcom, through NAM, they've been assisting artisanal miners in terms of moving away from mercury to borax. But the DMR is not part of those activities. It's not part of those initiatives. There's Mintec. DMR is not part of. So there's arrogance in the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy. There's arrogance that is happening there because they don't listen to any other proposals that are coming from other departments or other institutions or such of Human Rights Commission. Because what they were looking at, the Human Rights Commission, they were looking at human rights violations that are happening within the artisanal mining sector, within mining communities itself, which also speaks to the CS or the socioeconomic impact assessment that was done by DMR. But when you look at the bill, it's not there. When you listen to what Mineral Council is saying, any measures that are meant to respect human rights are not are hindering the industry from reaching its potential. So corporate speaks that language. The department follows that language. We as civil society and communities are saying, as much as we benefit or we understand that mining is part of our economy, but it needs to be responsible. No, they don't listen to that. When other departments say mining needs to be responsible, workers are not compensated accordingly. 2012, show us. Remember, 2012, they were fighting for 12.5, whereas they were getting 4.5 in 2012, after 30 years or 20 years of democracy. So it tells you there's a lot that is happening within the sector that the government is literally ignoring and not that ensuring that there's no improvement because they listen to corporate more than the state.
They listen to the community.
The citizens, yes. That's the challenge there.
Wow. So while communities are navigating survival, safety and livelihoods on the ground, the political debate sounds a little bit different in Parliament. Earlier, I also spoke to ATM MP and member of the Minerals and Energy Portfolio Committee on how government views illegal mining. I think everybody who's on social media and cares about the issue of illegal mining, zamazamas, and what's happening there has probably heard the voice note of you taking the minister, Gwede Mantashe, to task there on that day. And you did not mince your words.
Indeed. Look, what made me upset that day, it's how Minister Mantashe, number one, gaslit the committee. And secondly, did refuse to take responsibility and any form of accountability on the state of illegal mining in South Africa. And what I posited there was that the reason why illegal mining is at the levels in which it is in now, it is the lack of political will. And I reminded Minister that when we started off, I don't know what could have been done prior to 2019. But when we started off, because I joined that portfolio committee in 2019, when we started off, illegal mining was not to this extent now, and he's been the minister since then. Now, for him to speak as if they are doing enough, for us, you know, for me personally, it did not cut it, because it can't be that things are getting worse, but at the same time you are saying you are doing enough. What is enough if things are getting worse? So that was my irritation on the day.
So the portfolio committee has oversight on the department itself, and you know and understand what's coming down the road. Do you think that there are any concrete legislative reforms that are coming?
When it comes to reforms, there is a General Laws Amendment Bill, which was designed to fill in the gaps when it comes to the issues of illegal mining, because there are instances whereby there's going to be gaps in the law that somewhat inhibit the full implementation of programs or the programs to deal with illegal mining. In that meeting, the minister said that bill is before Parliament. Whereas in the very same presentation, the presentation states that the bill is currently with the state attorney, meaning it's not before Parliament. However, the minister attempted to shift the blame to us as Parliament that we are failing to do our work instead of locating where the bill is. So what I was raising particularly is how the minister, whether it's lawmaking, it's oversight, it's actually dealing with the problem, he's placing all the blame to Parliament.
So in Parliament where you sit, what kind of timelines are you looking at? So for me, as a person on the outside, as a South African, when can I expect to start seeing any of these legislative reforms coming into play, being debated in Parliament, and then eventually becoming passed as law?
I think before we get to the law aspect of things, I think the biggest challenge that South Africa faces is not the absence of law, rather the lack of enforcement when it comes to law. Some of the laws that are currently in place should be dealing with the problem. I'll make an example. When it comes to the laws that are under the Department of Mineral and Petroleum Resources, if you are a mine owner and you are done with a particular mine and you don't foresee mining any further, the law stipulates that you need to close any shaft so that there aren't any dangers. Now, the reason why illegal miners are able to go into the shafts, abandoned shafts, and extract whatever minerals that are there, it is because those shafts are not closed. So the law is there that directs that a mine must close a shaft before they somewhat wind up their mining operations. However, that is not being done. So that is the problem that we are facing. Currently, there's a meeting today where the SNDF and police are briefing Parliament on the issues of when the president announced during SONA that there's going to be deployment of SNDF to the illegal mining hotspots. So there should be change in the sense that there's going to be now some soldiers that are put on the ground to deal with the issue.
So on the one side, often framed by government, that illegal mining is a security threat. It's one of the things that you spoke about, talking about the Lesotho Prime Minister and the Lesotho nationals in particular. And the research is out there. The information exists of how much illegality happens around areas that have multiple and multitudes of people going underground and mining illegally. Right. But are you equally, as Parliament, looking at this as an economic inclusion conversation too? Because there's an economy that exists because of this illegal activity or the unpermitted mining that happens, small scale or artisanal mining. There's an economic around it. There is lots of economic activity. And because of poverty and unemployment, this does also begin to address some of those economic inclusion matters. Does Parliament consider this in your deliberations? And how do you consider it?
Indeed. Hence, in the Portfolio Committee and also with the department, our view is that there's a difference between illegal mining and artisanal mining. Illegal mining, it's when you mine illegally without following due process in terms of getting a license and, you know, following the relevant legislation. Artisanal mining, it's mostly done by small-scale miners, whereby they are given authority because they've applied for a license, they abide by the laws, and basically what they are doing has been sanctioned by the state. Whereas when it comes to illegal mining, it's a completely different conversation because we're talking about a criminal activity. So the issue here is that people normally conflate the two. I remember even the Human Rights Commission was having a conversation about the two, in fact, about illegal mining. And they were incorrectly saying illegal mining is artisanal mining. And people from the department were very quick to remind them, when you speak about artisanal mining or small-scale mining, this is what the definition is in accordance to the legislation that governs mining in our country. However, when you speak about illegal mining, we are completely talking about criminals who break the law, extract resources, and at the same time commit other atrocities and crimes in the process. So that is the distinction. So whilst you may have instances of people wanting economic inclusion in the form of using whatever means that are possible when it comes to trying to make a living on the mining side of things, but we must not conflate the two. I know currently as a committee, we are caught in the middle about even the basic definition of illegal mining. For example, if you are staying in a community that has sand, either you are staying close to a river, once you take that sand and without the necessary protocols and adherence to the laws, and you sell it to either a person who makes bricks or you take it wherever, in that definition, it is illegal mining, because sand, according to the definition, it is a mineral which, you know, there needs to be processes to be followed before you can take that sand to the, you can extract that sand basically. So, but when it comes to illegal mining, it's something else. And the results show how it is a criminal activity instead of economic inclusion activity.
Well, also, you know, the big companies, the big mining companies, Sibanye-Stillwater being one of them, have often spoken about the economic impact on their business and their business running, having to deal with the security and securing some of their maybe disused shafts, pardon me, and some of their further operations, right? Do you think that this kind of illegal mining activity could have the kind of impact on big mining companies as we've seen with the illicit tobacco trade, for instance, where BAT is shutting down its operations in Heidelberg, right? Because in Heidelberg, because they see that the illicit trade of cigarettes has impacted their business so much. Do you foresee, if nothing is done with illegal mining, that big mining companies could also be impacted in this way and they could find themselves shutting down and leaving the country?
My assertion is that there is no way illegal mining can thrive to this extent in our country without politicians, without government officials, either in SEBS, in SARS, in Home Affairs, and at the same time, mining houses. Because the mining houses know exactly where the product, the value of the product, where it needs to go to, etc. So the syndicates that includes these different groups of people, for me, also includes the mining houses. Now, I don't know whether it can get to that extent, but the manner in which it is getting worse, I would not, I would not put it past the status of illegal mining that it would not lead to the closure of mines in our country. However, most of the time, we always treat the mining houses as if they are innocent bystanders in all of this, because our view is that they are the ones who should have closed the shafts. The fact that they have not closed the shafts, it means they themselves are contributing to this lawlessness. The second issue is that there is no way in which a miner, whether a person, yes, was working in the mines, has got the skills and expertise to mine, but they do not know where the product has to go to, because we do not process our gold in South Africa. The gold is actually processed outside of South Africa. Who is coming? Who is a mine worker that was working all of his shifts underground, who then knows that these are the channels to follow to move the product from an illegal mining site in Gauteng or in Northwest all the way to being processed somewhere in Europe? Hence, you find that in our view, the mining houses, therefore, have got a role to play or are somewhat embedded in this criminal activity. It might not be all of them in terms of all of the mining houses that exist in South Africa, but definitely there's no way illegal mining can prosper and can thrive the way it is thriving now without the mining houses.
So you did mention earlier that you're going to be listening to a plan by the SAPS and the SANDF with regard to, as per the President's Sona speech, how they're going to deploy forces around various illegal mining activities that have been identified, or hotspots that have been identified. And I think about the Operation Valumgoti that ended earlier last year, and the fact that after the operation, when those forces, those armed forces withdrew, the illegal activity just ramped up again. So it's not really a solution. It's just a clampdown. How are you going to ensure that going into this next round of some kind of activity and proactiveness around illegal mining and the impact that it has on communities, how are you going to ensure that it is a more sustained long-term effect as the committee, and more importantly, that it is the illegal miners and the value chain, as you have correctly pointed out, that are impacted and not the community?
Our strong view is that there needs to be a focus on the syndicates. When we are receiving a presentation in the last couple of years about some illegal miners that were arrested, I think it was Free State, we got a profile there. One of them was a 12-year-old boy from Mozambique. And we kept asking questions. This 12-year-old boy, who or what does he know about, illegal mining in the sense of the value chain, in terms of moving the product out of the country? And we kept emphasizing to the department to say, if you don't deal with the syndicates, because it is the syndicates that drive illegal mining, whilst you as the SAPS, the SNTF, are going to arrest, if you go to an operation, you go to a shaft, whether it's Stilfontein, wherever, where there's illegal mining, yes, you may arrest those 5 or 6 people that are illegally mining there. But you need to interrogate them thoroughly to take them to the next layer, interrogate the next layer to the next layer, so that ultimately you get to the big bosses, the people that actually pump in the money to encourage illegal mining. Because if those people are arrested and aren't arrested, which is the top layer leadership that encourages or drives illegal mining, what's most likely to happen is that the illegal miners that are arrested are going to go to jail, but new ones are going to come in and fill in that particular spot because there's a gap, because there's a demand. So once you get rid of the demand or you close the demand, we'd have dealt with it. And at the same time, you need to make it so unprofitable to an extent whereby if someone wants to think about mining illegally, they must think about the repercussions, they must think about how it is so unprofitable to an extent whereby they get to be discouraged completely. But currently, people get arrested, and also we need to hold accountable the courts, the magistrates, because a person is arrested for illegal mining. He's illegal in the country. There's so many crimes that he's committed, but he's going to be given bail. So what needs to be done, it is something that is much broader instead of just focusing on the policing side, because the policing side could be done, yes, but if there is lack of insight and lack of appreciation on how the problem is, from a justice point of view, the magistrates are still going to be giving bail or just sentences that aren't really making sense to the very same people. And the very same people, if not, they are going to go back to their respective countries, or they are going to go back to those shafts again and mine. So it needs something that is more broader.
Mr. Zungula, and I hear what you're saying about the policing and about the entire court system on the one side. But you, as the parliamentary committee, are the oversight body of the Department of Minerals and Energy. So essentially representing us, you are our voices, and therefore you are the bosses of the where you talk to me about that the laws exist, but there is no enforcement. The department, you spoke earlier about all of these disused mines. I think the number sits at around 6,000 abandoned and disused mines. And there is money that has been put aside for the rehabilitation of these things, but the department hasn't done its work. Why do we not see recommendations from the parliamentary committee for officials to be fired because they're not doing their job? If I don't do my job, I get fired. Why do these officials in the Department of Minerals not get fired?
Definitely, there should be some form of consequences for them, because almost every time there's an oversight where we physically go to these disused mines, abandoned shaft, etc., we always issue a report that says, this is what the law says, and this is how they are failing to enforce the law when it comes to ensuring, because the department needs to ensure that the mine owners are the ones that close those shafts. Failing which, if, for example, a mine owner cannot be tracked, and it's something that also boggles our minds, because it can't be that the department has been running for ages but will not know who is the mine owner of a particular shaft, and suddenly when that mine shaft needs to be closed, suddenly there's no owners. Now the department needs to take responsibility to actually close those mines by the department. So that is what we've been calling. However, there's slow pace of implementation or low implementation when it comes to the department to our recommendations as a committee, and all of our reports, we table it now to the House of Parliament. It no longer becomes a portfolio committee report. It becomes a resolution of the House because it's been adopted by the House. And however, you're still going to have instances whereby the departments do not enforce. That is why we keep raising these issues. And when we have these meetings with the ministers, we keep reminding them to say, this is what report XYZ that was adopted by the House in 20-something says, therefore, why are you not doing it? They'll complain about resources, they'll complain about capacity, but on our side, we are pushing them.
I suppose it's a full circle moment back to that voice note that's been circulating of your submission, that there seems to be no political will.
Yeah, definitely no political will. And, when the government wants to do something, it does it. And we always make, people to remember the times of the COVID-19 lockdown. When the government wanted people to stay indoors, people stayed indoors because there's political will at the time. Currently, you find that on this particular issue, it becomes only topical when, for example, it happened in Randfontein, when communities left, you know, their community or their houses, and they were finding refuge in the community hall in Randfontein, only for the government officials to say they are going to move the communities to a safer area, except, you know, instead of dealing with the actual problem, which is illegal miners. So that is the problem which you are dealing with. You are dealing with a government that does not want to confront the problem. Again, I think also on the side of government, they are wanting to be politically correct. Remember when Minister Javeni said they must be smoked out, there was a huge noise to say, but violation of human rights, etc. Even when in Stilfontein, the illegal miners were refusing to come out and police were like, we're going to wait for you to come out. The Human Rights Commission and other NGOs also went in there and said it is the violation of human rights. So the problem also with South Africa is that there is other institutions or organizations that make so much noise when criminals are being arrested or criminals are dealt with, and they keep quiet when law-abiding citizens are terrorized, like in Randfontein. I asked, where was the Human Rights Commission in Randfontein? Where was these NGOs who were protecting illegal miners in Stilfontein when communities found refuge in the community hall in Stilfontein? So I think that is the nature of our problem. Our problems are main as a country, but also one of the problems that we face, it is the liberal voices that want everything to be done in a politically correct way and without understanding the dangers that illegal mining poses, not only on the environment and the economy, but in the lives and livelihoods of law-abiding poor citizens of our country.
Sure. I think it is a really hard thing to find a way to balance all of these interests and what can be and what should be. Thank you very much, sir, for your time. I know we've stolen you away from other portfolio committee arrangements, and we'll always appreciate the time that you give to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless.
Illegal mining is often presented as a law and order crisis. But today we heard something deeper, a story about abandoned economies, excluded communities, and minerals that continue to attract survival long after formal industry leaves. The question facing South Africa is not only how to stop illegal mining, it is whether we can build a mining economy that includes the people who live closest to the wealth beneath our soil. Thank you for joining me.